This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
Ma'am, my brother Mike and I are asleep in the one bedroom at street level. When the window is smashed in from the outside, it is my father. Come the police with their sirens and flashing lights. Comes a big commotion, then a sudden quiet, and he is gone.
That's Alfie McCourt. We'll talk to him about Ireland, his adopted land, the U.S., and his memoir of his life in both.
If that agent opens the negotiation at $75,000 or $150,000, that's where it's going to be. If the agent opens the negotiation at $5,000 or $7,000, it's going to be there.
And that's novelist Beverly Swerling. We talk with her and husband Bill Martin about literary agents and how to find them. That's coming up in the second half of the show. But first, Alfie McCourt and A Long Stone's Throw. Alfie McCourt isn't as famous a writer as his two older brothers, Frank and Malachi McCourt. In fact, until recently, he wasn't a writer at all. He was a restaurateur and then a building manager in New York City. But he's got the same talent for memoir as his more celebrated siblings. He's just come out with a memoir of growing up in Limerick, Ireland, and, after emigrating, his life here in the U.S. A Long Stone's Throw contains wry observations of both cultures, passages of great lyricism, and darker observations of poverty and injustice in his native land. I was in Manhattan recently and took the opportunity to visit McCourt in his apartment on the Upper West Side. I found him a gracious host, as was his wife, Lynn. As we sat down together on his living room couch, I observed that Ireland and America were a long stone's throw from each other. But, McCourt told me, that wasn't the inspiration for the title of his book.
Well, it's actually from the text in the book, from where I was born, where we lived, to the Redemptorist Church, which was across O'Connell Avenue. I described it as a long stone's throw. And, of course, the Redemptorist Church was the church of St. Alphonsus, who was the big chief of the Redemptorist Fathers. And I'm named after St. Alphonsus, so I'm very conscious about the location of the church. It was very much a dominant force in our lives, that particular church, probably more so. They're an order of preachers, very often hellfire preachers. They were the Catholic fundamentalists. We didn't know it at the time. If we had, we could have exposed.
Now, you're talking about a church that's in Limerick, but and you were born in Ireland, but two brothers were born in the United States.
Seven children were born. Five were born here in New York, in Brooklyn. Two of us, Michael and I, were born in Limerick. And as my brother Malachy pointed out lately, I was born at home. I was born in the lane. So I'm the only one who can be truthfully described as a laner, which is not the description to which we would have aspired at one time. But now it can be a badge of honor.
You're a liner?
Laner, L-A-N-E-R. To be born in the lane. We were a class of people. You know how they say the homeless, and they never say people. They don't say homeless people, they say the homeless. So that's a class of people. The laners, we were not laner people, we were the laners. We were a class of people far down in the social register.
Yes, and in fact, you have a wonderful passage in your book, quite a few passages in your book, A Long Stone's Throw, that describe the kind of poverty that you grew up in when you were young. But one in particular, I was going to ask you to read this a little bit later on, but since you've already kind of jumped right into it, I'd like you to read it now. But before we get to it, actually, set us up. Tell us, where are you? And tell us a little bit about your mom and your dad. Why this passage?
Well, it's an awkward kind of a passage, because at this time, we were living in the house of my mother's first cousin, one singular. And as I said, there were goings on in that house. The goings on have been described in more detail in Frank's book, Angela's Ashes, that there was sex and all the rest of it up in the loft. And we could hear it, so, I mean, if we hadn't been living there, we might well have been homeless, or we might have been split up and sent off to orphanages or something like that. So I guess she did what she had to do when she had to do it. And I was very young. I was probably 4 or 5 years old. My brother Mike was 4 years older. And I didn't understand what it was all about. But you have a sense. Children have a real sense. Like they say, dogs smell fear. I think children can smell evil, a sense of something. But we had a sense of what was going on there. It was very difficult. We were living in the dire poverty, not one day to the next, but one meal to the next. And I was thinking today when I was shaving, I was thinking this was in the early 1940s, and that's just about 100 years since the famine, as they call it, the Great Hunger. 100 years later, we were still at it. We reinvented our own famine.
And what was, your mother was having a relationship with her cousin.
Yeah.
What was it that was so dark about that?
Well, he was very unkind to my brothers, but he was never unkind to me. It's a strange thing, maybe because I was the smallest, but he was very rough and ready in his ways. I think there was an element of a good element of violence in him. There was violence, there was a lot of drinking. He was, I think, probably very frustrated because I believe he was an only child. He had been spoiled as a child and he had some education. And still he ended up working as a linesman for the electricity company, which in our town was a job. Any job was a good job. He had that job. It would be pensionable and benefits and all the rest of it, but still for him it was probably a come down. So he had all this frustration. He never married. So I think there was an element that he was probably brutal, not all the time, but from time to time. And there was always the threat.
So read to us this passage now.
Play we do, and yes, we do engage, but we are always hungry. Always waiting for Mam to come home, to light fire and lamp if we have coal and oil, and to cook if she has found any food. In Northern Ireland, they would have called us scaldies. Like little birds in the nest we are, waiting for mother bird or father bird to return and drop food into our beaks. Above all, whatever she brings, Mam brings herself. To a child, she brings the world just by being there. It is night time. Mam, my brother Mike, and I are asleep in the one bedroom at street level. When the window is smashed in from the outside, it is my father. Come the police with their sirens and flashing lights. Comes a big commotion, then a sudden quiet, and he is gone again. Fright gives way to puzzlement. Only later, when I grow up and find out what it is like to suffer jealousy, will I begin to understand. I almost feel sorry for him with his absolutist notions and his romantic temperament. In his rage and frustration, tilting at windows instead of windmills. When Mam refers to my father as your pop, I know it's her way of keeping herself at a distance from him. But for all her distancing and for all her your pops, I feel that she still has a soft spot for the old man. She must once have seen him do something extraordinary and remembered it, or she must have believed him capable of doing something great. Or maybe at one time, she had simply loved and admired him, embarrassed perhaps by what she had felt for him when she was young. It is with a touch of derision that she speaks of him now. It seems as if she is deriding my father for his foolish ways and mocking herself for her foolishness in having loved him. She has long since given up on him, but I still detect a touch of respect, a shade of admiration, and at least the memory of love. Someone once asked her, "Did you love Alfie's father?" "I did," she answered. "So what happened?" they pressed her. "What happened?" she repeated, and without hesitation. "Poverty flew in and love flew out. That's what happened."
Alfie McCourt, why does that happen? You speak a lot in your book about class and about poverty. It seems this is in some ways very much something often that people don't speak about with the same kind of clarity that the Irish do. You just referred to the potato famine. So this kind of oppression, this kind of class oppression, is really almost bred in the bone. Is it very much part of the culture, the art, the song of Ireland?
It has been, yeah. It's left over because we were, for the longest time, governed by another country, and we were subservient to absentee landowners. The landowners that owned these huge estates in Ireland, and they lived in England, they never came, they never showed up. They sent their bailiffs, and today dealt with the people, and oftentimes without any mercy. So there is, as you say, bread in the bone, it's in the blood, this kind of resentment. But the difficulty is that oftentimes there's the expression, the straw boss, when the big boss hires somebody else. He doesn't have any real, he doesn't pay him much money, but he gives him the cane and he gives him the power and he beats anybody. You know, there's a lot of that. People, we used to call it, you know, this kind of thing was like tuppence looking down on a penny halfpenny. Our problem, as I said in this book, A Long Stone's Throw, we were white among white, Catholic among Catholic, Irish among Irish. So why were we so downtrodden? We all look the same, sound the same, practice the same religion, and yet we were excluded. And that's, for me, that's the gist of the whole thing. It's not color or creed, none of that. It's just we were excluded because we were dirty and poor and all the rest of it.
And because you were fatherless.
Well, that's a stigma. That's a big stigma to be fatherless, especially if your father was away and he kept in touch, it would be okay. But if he's away and he doesn't keep in touch, that's the key. Some of these men stayed away forever. They stayed away for 20 years, but maybe they would come home once a year or every 2 years or send a few dollars home. So the connection remained. To all intents and purposes, they were still, the men were still the husband and the father of the children. So they didn't have what we had was the man who went and didn't come back, except in the middle of the night to break the window or something like that.
And why did he go? And why did he come back?
I don't know. I never got any explanation. I guess he was up to something. He came back and he got drunk and he came up. And I don't know. I never found out.
Why did he split to begin with? Now, he was in the United States?
He was, yeah. Mm-hmm. My mother and father met in the U.S., married in the U.S., and then during the Depression, they went back. I think my mother had something of a nervous breakdown. She told me once she was living in an apartment in New York, and the woman upstairs either tried to commit suicide or committed suicide by gas. Plus, my mother's little infant daughter had died, so it was all too much for her. So they ended up going back.
Your mother is really a tragic figure in your book, A Long Stone's Throw, and I'm speaking with Alfie McCourt, brother, youngest brother to Frank and Malachy McCourt. Your mother is really a kind of tragic figure in your book.
She was a spirited woman for all that. She was tragic, but she was... I don't think she knew she was tragic. She didn't walk around, you know, carrying a cloud. She didn't wear a bad thing. She just kind of went on from day to day, as a lot of people do who bear terrible burdens. They go on, go on, go on, go on. And she had... I think she was must have been... I have a sense, I don't know for sure, that she may have been sent off by her mother to go to the United States. I have a sense. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not true. I haven't discussed that with the older brothers. Maybe they know something, I don't know. But at least her departure was welcomed. Because there was nothing in Limerick anyway. There was nothing to keep anybody in Limerick.
The threat of immigration and emigration runs right through your book entirely. You begin in New York City, you go back to Limerick then as a child, and then come back to the United States. How many years have you been in this country?
50 years, 50 years this year, in December.
Do you still feel like an immigrant?
No. Some people seem to feel the need to make me feel like an immigrant. Sometimes people say, I had one man say to me one day, went down at work, oh, I'm going to call immigration on you. I was really insulted because he thought it was a joke. People seem to feel the need, especially now with the business of illegal aliens, as they call them. People seem to need to winnow out the immigrants, the aliens, and it's a way of feeling superior. If I'm a native and you're not, then I'm superior to you. I recognize it, but I think I've been here long enough to have earned my spurs, for better or for worse. I've done my thing, done my bit.
I guess I ask that question in a different sense, and that is, in your memoir, A Long Stone's Throw, you talk about the expectation when you were a child growing up in Ireland, the expectation that you had of yourself all along, that you would come to America. But not just you, but almost everyone around you expected that the young people would emigrate to America.
Well, everyone would leave, more or less. They wouldn't all come to the United States, some England, Australia, New Zealand, Canada. Some people would not come to the United States. They preferred Canada, and I always wondered about them. I guess I was noticed about the Canadians. Their plaid shirts are very different from American plaid shirts. I always wondered, is there any significance in that? But I always knew I would come here, I had no doubt. And in the 1950s, everybody was going. I don't know if I mentioned it in here, but in the 1980s, it happened again. And they said, will the last man leaving please turn off the light? That's how they put it. So it happened. Now, I don't know, maybe it's going to happen again. But there's no room here anymore. The irony of it is that President John Kennedy closed the door to the Irish.
Really?
Yeah, the folklore is that President Kennedy went to Ireland, and he went to visit the President of Ireland, Eamon de Valera, and de Valera said to him, John, I want you to do something for me. And John said, anything, Dev. And Dev said, I want you to stop immigration. And John said, okay, Dev. And he came back, and in no time, this is the folklore, in no time, they introduced legislation to make more favorable conditions for Southern Europeans and Asians and Africans. And I don't think it passed while Kennedy was alive. It passed after he died. But they say it's the irony of it. The Irish could come here. It was, you know, like opening the door. You could just walk in, but that's not the case anymore. And Kennedy did it. But we forgive him.
We've mentioned a little bit about your brothers, Frank and Malachy. In your memoir, you often talk about them. They're almost a kind of godlike figures. Say something about how you saw your older brothers, and do you still feel a little bit the same way as you did back then?
Well, there's a big age difference. Frank is 10 years older. Malachy is 9 years older. Mike is 4 years older. We were closer, but still, when you're, let's say, 5 years old and your brother is 15, that's a big gap. But if you're 15 and your brother is 25, that's a big, big gap. As you get older, it matters less. But then when your two oldest brothers achieve a certain eminence, the gap in age kind of buttresses the respect that you have for them, and the kind of, it's not adulation by any means, but you will always be in awe of them, because, and justifiably so, because of what they did. They left in misery, came here and created something, pulled themselves up out of, you know, washing dishes and doing all that, the most menial jobs, and they did it. So I will always respect them. I don't agree with them all the time. God knows I shouldn't.
In many ways, you followed in their very same footsteps. I mean, they got involved in the restaurant business, and so did you. And they became writers, and now you have a book out, and a beautifully written book, I have to say.
Thank you.
When you were in Ireland, you actually, in spite of your poverty, you and your brothers got a very excellent education. And in fact, you were the first to go on to school, to
secondary school.
So talk a little bit about that kind of education that you got, and what was so inspiring to you of it.
My education in Limerick, educated by the Christian Brothers, it was like a public school education, but done under the auspices of a religious order, a very peculiar thing. The fees were little or nothing because they were religious, so it was a kind of a marriage of convenience, public education, big emphasis on religion. But the sideline of that was a big emphasis on nationalism. They were very nationalistic, very Irish, because, you know, the independence from England was not that too far before, so we were kind of chauvinistic, and they were chauvinistic, and I became a bit chauvinistic. But what appealed to me was the music and the songs and the Gaelic language. To my shame, I was quite fluent when I came here, absolutely fluent in Gaelic, and now I don't speak it anymore, it's gone. Mm. But it really appealed to me. Maybe it was chauvinism, nationalism are often a kind of escape from misery, you know. People embrace the far away instead of dealing with what's more immediate.
And yet that was pretty immediate. You speak in your book of how you were involved in the political movement you were living in the Free State of Ireland, but there was still Northern Ireland. And I was quite surprised to read in your book, A Long Stone's Throw, that the Free Irish State was involved in the suppression of the liberation movement of Northern Ireland.
Yeah. Well, because government wants stability, and the government of it was now the Republic. It became a Republic in, I think, 1949, went from Free State to Republic. So they want stability. They want to stay in power. They don't want some characters coming along. And they were training in the South and going up over the border into the North. So if they're training in the South, then they would be, it was never said, but they would be capable of trying an overthrow of the Southern government, even though it's a very unlikely, but it's a paramilitary group, who knows? So, and the government also has to appear to be, you know, suppressing this in order to keep hand in glove with the British and all the rest. Yes, we're doing everything we can. So that was why.
You describe the Irish state as pretty repressive. You talk about the Irish Gestapo. And also the church itself doesn't come in for a whole lot of love from you.
Well, I never, I am not anti-Catholic, never was, never have been. But there was an aura of repression about the Irish Church, and the priests were remote. And then when they did approach, they didn't have much in the way of compassionate conservatism. You know, they were much more ham-fisted. They'd yell at you, and we used to go in fear. We used to actually salute a priest when we saw him. We would salute a policeman nearly when we saw him. Salute, We were, I remember, like we were playing ball in the street. There was a lone, one solitary policeman coming down riding his bike, and we would run in terror of this one policeman. It was very authoritarian. As far as the church, I don't know what it is with me. Some people disagree with doctrine. I just was very, very, very uncomfortable with the church, in the church. I still go down the street here. There's a church down here, the Church of the Blessed Sacrament. I go in there once in a while. I sit down. I say hello, and how are you, and how are things, and sit there for a while in perfect peace and quiet. I never go to Mass, never participate. And if I could have had it that way all my life, instead of parading around with banners and all the rest of it, and bowing down and beating your chest when some... I was very uncomfortable.
You have a wonderful anecdote in your book, a scene where a neighbor comes into the church and he strips down. He strips his clothes off. Mm. And you're shocked, not by him, but by the reaction of those around him. Tell us what happened and why were you shocked by your neighbors and not by your neighbor?
It was actually in the street, in the lane. It was not in the church. It was in the lane behind the church. We lived at the back of St. Joseph's Church. And he came home. He was a seaman. His mother was elderly, so I guess he came to stay home for a couple of weeks. Part of the thing was the season of the year was springtime, Easter time. I know I could feel the weather. The sun was shining, and it was a little bit humid. Very strange, and I don't know how old I would have been, 8 or 9 years old. It's a time when, springtime, when the sensibilities are hanging out, you know, exposed, and you're very keenly aware. But I can still feel it, the sunshine and the humidity, very rare for us. But I was shocked at him, but maybe not altogether shocked, because in many societies, it's the women that, in poorer societies, the women adhere to the church. The men stand in the back and mutter, right, and they go all right, but they stand, like some of the men in Limerick would stand at the back of the church in the vestibule. And they'd actually be looking out at the street, watching whatever traffic or girls might be going by. Meanwhile, the Mass is going on inside. But to all intents and purposes, they attended Mass. So he, I guess, I don't think he was married either, another unmarried man, you know, and this frustrations build up and whatever happened. He had some drinks and he got carried away. But the neighbors, like he was away at sea, but he was one of us. And these were his close neighbors. And he was obviously very disturbed and very unhappy. And they laughed at him. I couldn't believe that they would do that to their neighbor, that somebody wouldn't comfort him or throw a blanket around him or something.
Why don't you read that passage there? It's on page 95.
Early on that sunny, humid Saturday afternoon, with the mission coming to an end, Jackie may have had too many drinks, or more likely, he's had his fill of piety. In the middle of Schoolhouse Lane, he rages aloud about religion in general and about the mission in particular. "I'll give ye a mission! I'll give ye a mission!" he shouts as he rails against hypocrisy of priests and people. He begins to take off his clothes. Jacket and shirt come first, then singlet and belt and shoes and socks. The more he takes off, the more his Christian neighbors laugh. I don't know exactly, but I sense what he means. There's little or no love in the mission, and I am shocked that they don't help him, these adults, his neighbors. For his sake and for the sake of his mother, why don't they stop him from taking off his clothes? And I hate them for laughing at him, because I sense what he means, And I can see how little anybody cares. It makes me sick. I run away. I don't want to see how far it will go.
How old were you at this point?
Probably about 8 or 9.
You were a pretty sensitive kid.
I suppose so, yeah. But I think all kids are sensitive. I mean, what kid would welcome a display like that? What kid? I mean, there were situations in Limerick where you know, if you get one dog mounted another and then they got turned around, the two dogs would be pulling it off and then somebody would come, everybody would laugh, but somebody would come out with a bucket of cold water, throw it on them, they would separate. They did that for two dogs. They didn't do anything for him.
Do you miss Ireland?
I miss the air, I miss the light. I miss maybe my idea of Ireland, but I don't know what's there now.
You're listening to WMUA 91.1 FM in Amherst. And we're talking with Alfie McCourt about his memoir, A Long Stone's Throw.
You actually say in your book, Alfie McCourt, that every emigrant, when he comes back to Ireland, is coming back to the Ireland of his imagination.
Yeah, they said that one time. They said that about Dublin. Dublin is a place to which exiles return to dream of an Ireland that never was. But you can go and drive. I remember on my first trip back to Ireland, I had been 7 years here, and I flew into Shannon Airport, and I'm the big yank. I got a taxi, and there was a girl waiting there at the bus stop. So I offered her a ride. And in between my departure, the 7 years, they had started building in Shannon Airport, because like an idiot, I was saying, oh boy, I'm the yank now. I know all about development and the evils of I say, they're building too fast, too much. This is terrible. They're going to destroy. And then this girl, she did not like it. She accepted the ride into the city, but she got out. She didn't want to hear me anymore. I learned to keep my mouth shut then when you go someplace like that.
Now, although you trained to become a solicitor, actually, for a while in Ireland, you came back here without doing that and got into the restaurant business and then eventually worked for not a developer but an apartment complex. Mm. Now you've written this memoir. This is your first book.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about the process of doing this memoir. Was this a long time coming for you? Was it difficult for you? Where did you uncover the memories for it?
Well, I was, a reluctant bridegroom, because anything coming after Frank's Angela's Ashes is imitative. So I had to think about that. And I started writing, and then I wrote a lot. I went to Pennsylvania for 4 days, all alone, down in the mountains in the Poconos, stocked up on whatever provisions I would need. Went up to this small house, and for 4 days I was by myself. And the first half of the book just flowed out. I didn't go anywhere for 4 days. I went outside and walked around, but I didn't go down to buy milk, because I knew, you know, if you do that, you'll find a reason. Maybe I'll go to the movies, take a break, you know. It was very, very good. That was the easy part. The difficult part was doing the second half of the book, which is more involved with my life as an adult. The childhood stuff is much easier. And as far as memory goes, people say, did you keep a diary? Did you keep a journal? I didn't, no. But early memories, I think, are lucid, are very clear. The things that register with you as a child really, really, really register. A lot of stuff won't register, but those things that do will really have an impact. So later on, I started continuing, and I tried writing it 6 ways from Sunday, and I had to change the chronology and start here and go back to Limerick and come, which was actually how it ended up being. And I'm happy I did it that way, because I didn't want just a repetition. You know, with all of these things, I have pegs on which I can hang my hat. There are anchors, there are events, and I can remember the event, and then I can remember what happened. The latter part is difficult because you have to be, with the kind of life I've lived, you have to be wary of writing any kind of confessional. That's not what I'm trying to do. I just try to write it as it happened, without apology, without explanation. There are the reasons why I live my life as I did, but if I got into all of that, then you become a confessional. I don't know that we need any more confessionals, do we?
And why did you want to write a memoir?
Why did I? Well, because, well, if somebody asked me that, I said the short answer is self-defense.
Self-defense?
Yeah, it's a joke, you know. I said I want to be more than a footnote in the history of my own family. I could say all of those things. Mm-hmm. Some of them are more or less true. That's why.
Alfie McCourt, thanks so much for talking with us and for inviting me into your lovely home as well.
And thank you, Francesca. It's been a great pleasure and also a learning experience. Thank you.
Alfie McCourt lives with his wife, his daughter, and his cat on Manhattan's Upper West Side. His memoir, A Long Stone's Throw, is published by Hatchet. They also have an audiobook of it, read by the author. Next up, we talk with novelist Beverly Swerling and her husband Bill Martin about what writers need to look for in a literary agent.
I'll be marching along in the big parade on St. Patrick's Day. I'll be up to me neck in shamrocks as I march along the way. I'll swing that old shillelagh as I wave to each colleen, and tilt me ear the better to hear the wearing of the green.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We spoke to novelist Beverly Swerling earlier this year about her new book, City of God. It's the third in a historical series about old New York. Back in the 1980s, she'd already published several books when it dawned on her that she wasn't really getting what she was worth from the deals her agent was making with publishers. Her husband, Bill Martin, thought a couple of weeks of research into the arcane field of literary agency might enable him to give her a hand. 25 years later, he's still at it, and Swerling has joined him in the business. It's called agentresearchandevaluation.com. Well, Bev Swerling, welcome back to Writer's Voice, along with your husband, Bill Martin, who works with writers around getting literary agents. How would you describe yourself, Bill?
Good looking.
No.
And
That's true. It's a consultancy, Francesca.
Yeah.
The business is a consultancy for writers looking for a new agent or sometimes a first agent.
Yeah, and I started it because she was very unhappy with the agent she had. And I told her, give me a month or so and I'll do some research and we'll come up with another one. His real problem was he was a Yalie and I'm Princeton.
So how did you go about doing this? How did you know what to do?
Part of the Princeton education was writing a thesis. And that really taught you how to do research. And the research I did was in the daily newspapers, the New York Times, and then in the trade magazines. And I got information that nobody had ever put together before.
What kind of information?
The most essential thing was the nature of the advance that had been negotiated by the agent for his client, and then the nature of the rights that were sold. And those still are the most vital pieces of information that an author needs in order to choose a literary agent.
Why is that?
Well, they like to eat. The authors like to eat. And how much a publisher pays for the advance really emphasizes how, like in any other business, how much commitment they got behind the book. If they put down six figures, they're going to work like hell to sell the book. And then the nature of the rights is important because World Rights, for example, does a great disservice to the author.
And explain what that is.
World Rights means that they give the baby away with the bathtub.
Can I get in on that for a second?
Yeah.
Because it's something that writers misunderstand all the time, which is that when world rights are sold, when an agent sells world rights to a book, he is giving the publisher the right to participate in the foreign sales. A good agent, for instance, we're talking about America, so a good agent in America is going to try to sell North American rights only, because then the foreign sales will accrue totally to the author, less the agent's commission. Otherwise, they will accrue with a split between the publisher and the author, and then the agent's commission as usual. Go on, honey.
It's a real disservice to the author, and unfortunately is becoming more and more common. It's one of the ways you tell a good agent from the not so good, is if they always sell world rights, they're taking the easy route. They can do more volume if they sell the world rights. Now, the good agents have specialists who handle foreign sales. And I think it's a fair statement that most good writers probably in total make more money out of the sale of foreign rights and other subsidiary rights than they do out of the original sale.
The primary sale. And I think a lot of writers don't understand that, well, there's two things they don't understand, which is what has made Bill's business so viable, which is that, A, they should be making a selection. Writers work alone in a room looking at a blank screen. You're not totally normal if you're willing to do that to start out with. And they tend to feel, they are, in fact, so dependent on the agent that many writers, even writers, I mean, we get clients come to Bill who have, you know, been on the bestseller list for months at a time. And they're still, when it comes to looking for an agent, they'll come in and they'll say, I just don't know. And, you know, they're being headhunted by all kinds of people. And they can look at a lot of data these days on the net, but they don't really have a lot of information. That they need to make rigorous choices, and they need somebody to help them understand what those rigorous choices have to be.
Yeah, and unfortunately, most writers don't really want to fool around with the business aspect of what they're doing. They just want to write. And, you know.
Hear.
Yeah, that's what I say, too. I was just going to say the same thing, Francesca. Hear. Yes.
I'd like to kind of go down some of these ways, some of this information that you're talking about. And I want to go back to something that you said way back in the beginning, that you said the two most important things were that an author...
With the advance and the nature of the rights that his primary agent is selling.
Exactly. So what about things like being able to be friends with your agent, to have a good relationship with your agent, to have an agent that'll even call you back, all those kinds of things, which are complaints that I often hear from authors, that their agents are difficult to work with.
That happens so frequently. We hear a lot of that. And, you know, that's exactly the kind of point that Bill was making about my unhappiness with what was then my second agent at the time he was talking about. He sold my stuff, but every time I got off the phone with him, I was in tears. He didn't get it. He didn't get where I was as a writer.
He also had a niche that he was selling into, the romance writers.
And I've never written a romance in my life.
And she had never even read one of these things. They called them bodice busters in those days. And he could make those quick sales for chicken feed. And see, he wanted Beverly to keep writing that stuff. And if you've written one, it's a format almost. And he wanted her to keep doing it, which was dull and
not
professionally advantageous.
Yeah, I don't mean to sound, by the way, in this as if we're slamming romance writers, because we're not. It's a genre, and it works, and there are people who work in it, and many of them come to us looking for help, and come to ARNE looking for help, and get it. But it wasn't what I did. I did one because he talked me into it. He sold it, and as a matter of fact, I think I finally stopped receiving royalties on that book about 7 or 8 years ago, and this thing was sold over 30 years ago.
And what I'm hearing you saying is that it's not just important that the agent be a good agent in terms of being able to sell your work, but also that they can represent what you do.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah. A good agent wants to help you develop your career.
Now, let me ask you a question. I'm going to take myself as an example. Maybe this is unfair. But years ago, before I even began to do writer's voice, I did a book query. I found an agent who had sold nonfiction to the biggest publishing houses. And I was an unknown, a total unknown. I had a compelling story. Let's just say it's a story that takes place in World War II of a very fascinating group, and I've been working on it for a long time. And it's a kind of memoir.
Okay.
It was a good story, and he liked it, and he worked with me for a long time. He helped me make a pretty good book proposal, I think. And then he shopped it around to the six top publishing houses in New York. And I got rejected by all of them because they said they didn't know who I was, although I was a good writer. You know, who would be interested in a story from somebody they don't know? And I wasn't a cultural historian. Hmm. What was wrong with that picture?
Well, my first thought is that unless this took place 20, 25 years ago, if this took place within the last 10 years.
1998, yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. So yeah, we're still talking about what I want to talk about, which is that nonfiction these days demands a launch pad. And what he hadn't, it seems to me, talked about was how you were going to have a launch pad that could help you sell the book. One of the things that can help writers in that position, if you can get blurbs recommending the book from people who have the credentials that you do not have, then that can help to move the thing forward. Plus, also, in terms of going back with a proposal that was shopped in 1998, the editors who looked at that proposal are no longer at the same houses. You, in effect, have a virgin material as far as the publishing world is concerned. And this, by the way, is the kind of information that makes AR&E valuable. This is what we do.
The most important thing we do is what we call a fingerprint proposal, in which somebody comes in, particularly with the kind of thing you've just talked about, and Beverly talks back and forth with them in terms of getting out exactly what kind of story they want to write. And on the basis of that, we can then select at least a half dozen agents who are handling exactly that kind of material and therefore are the ones most likely to be able to sell the stuff.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Beverly Swerling and Bill Martin of Agent Research. Now, about Agent Research, tell us more about what you guys do.
Okay, it's Agent Research and Evaluation. We do those two things. We do the research and we evaluate the agents. The most common way that we do that is through what we call a customized fingerprint, which we were just talking about a minute ago. You sign up for the customized fingerprint.
Interruption. You sign up online, usually. All of this is on our website at agentresearch.com.
Yeah. And once we get your order in, then Beverly starts emailing back and forth to pin down exactly what you're doing. And it's on the basis of that that we come up with at least a half dozen agents who are handling that specific kind of material. And the full report is the clients that the agent wants to brag about and what he's done for them in terms of who he sold to,
what rights he sold, and how much he got.
Yeah. And then we suggest that you approach all of them at the same time.
Oh, really? I thought you're not supposed to do that.
Well, that's their story. Any more than they send the manuscript out to several publishers at the same time, but they don't want to admit that either. Let me make an amendment to what I just said. We're dealing with some people who are very experienced in the publishing field. They can come in and ask us to give them details about a specific agent that they think they might be interested in. That's what we call a dead reckoning report. Then there are other people who, unfortunately, the business is full of crooks.
And tell us a little bit about some of the scams.
Yeah, well, you know, there is no licensing in either the U.S., Canada, or the U.K. of who can call themselves an agent. Anybody can call themselves an agent. There's not even any bonding. So that's why the business is rampant with crooks. And I define a crook as somebody who has never sold a manuscript to a major publisher and who makes upfront charges. Charges, sometimes they call them reading charges, they call them everything under the sun. And that's where they make their money. And unfortunately, the business is full of them.
Bill runs one free service on his site called Agent Verification, in which people can go and put in the name of
an agent
for free, and we'll tell them, you know, whether or not
they're good guys, they're bad guys, and we don't know a damn thing about them.
Right, exactly. And there's a lot of people that come into that. But this group has about 20 different names that it works under. Poets Agency, Children's Agency, Writers Literary Agency. It changes names every 2 days. And
their address is a mail drop on Fifth Avenue in New York, and they live in Florida.
Right. Wow. And then one of the people at the top, there's someone with that same name who's been indicted, and I think it's Oregon. I'm not at my desk, so I don't have the data. But for fraud, some sort of fraudulent stock thing. So it's a very, you know, it's. But what they do, the reason I got into this, is they'll come back and say to you, fine, but now we need a critique by a specialist who's in critiquing, and that's only $75. Okay, listen, $75 is not the end of the world. And then people send that in, and the next thing will then, recently there's been a co-publishing outfit, that's another very common scam, whereby you'll pay part of the publication things, and we'll get you this great publisher, and these co-publishing deals are always scams. And so in the end of it, people wind up losing thousands of dollars. And more than that, they lose their dreams.
And these are not stupid people who come in. They're lawyers, they're doctors, they're university professors.
And they get taken by these things because publishing is so arcane, and so people don't know what goes on.
Now, I want to go back to something again that you said in the beginning. This whole idea of the advances, I mean, the publishing industry is changing tremendously.
Yep.
And what I hear from a lot of authors that I talk to is that, you know, advances are extremely tiny unless you are already a blockbuster author, that it's very, very hard to get your foot in the door. I mean, something like, I don't know, 100,000 books are published in this country every year.
Even higher numbers.
Yep.
Right. So what does this idea of advance really mean about an agent?
An agent opens the negotiation where he thinks it should be opened. And who that agent is, that's why which agent you have is so important. Because if that agent opens the negotiation at $75,000 or $150,000, that's where it's going to be. If the agent opens the negotiation at $5,000 or $7,000, it's going to be there. The agent's reputation is why the editors talk to him or her. And it is that reputation for picking winners. Nobody knows in publishing, including the editors and the head publishers. Nobody knows what's going to be a winner and what isn't. When Dan Brown sold Da Vinci Code, he had sold two or three books previously that went nowhere. And the editor, I know for a fact that the editor went out to lunch with people who I know after Da Vinci Code had become the big hit and said if it had come over my desk, I'd have rejected it because I figured I just didn't know how to sell this guy.
That's a very interesting example. You say, and I, of course I agree with you, that you know the most important thing is that an author write a good book. Now, I have to say, I don't think Da Vinci Code was a well-written book.
It's a terribly written book.
Yeah, and it was a blockbuster, and certainly there are a lot of good books that go nowhere.
Yep.
So somehow in here, how do you work in an industry that is, you know, has been, I'm going to say, pathologically taken over by people who are only interested in the bottom line? It's a very different industry than it was in the 50s and 60s where you
the gentleman's agreement business of old days.
And it's going to get even more different in the immediate future.
You know, and
you know, Francesca, one of the things that I think authors are making a mistake, they're really down in the mouth about where the publishing industry is going. I think where it's going is going to be great for authors because, for instance, when I started in this stuff, we were using hot type. Then we moved to photo offset. And now we're moving to, you know, a whole new field. And each step has made for more readers and more writers. And I think that's what, you know, authorship is all about.
But I don't think the genre novel, and even the badly written genre novel, is not going to go away. But up to about 2 years ago, and even I haven't seen the figures for last year, but I suspect they're going to be the same. The so-called literary novel, which the way we use the term in publishing today, it really means the mainstream novel. The so-called literary novel sold as individually more than any other books that were out there. When Alice Siebold wrote, Lucky did well, but Lovely Bones did phenomenally well. That kind of book still has a market, still sells, and still gets a very good advance.
Francesca, mm-hmm. One of the things that shows up on our website is Beverly's experience of moving from this Yaley to Henry Morrison. And Henry went back to the same acquiring editors with the same...
No, it wasn't the same manuscript, but it was the same acquiring editor with the same publishing house.
Yeah.
And got six times the advance that the other guy had been getting $25,000 advances for my books. And Henry went back to the same editor and said, I want better money than this, and I'm looking for six figures. He wound up selling the book for $150,000.
Wow. I'm talking with Bill Martin of Agent Research and Evaluation and Beverly Swerling, author and also consultant with her husband Bill's company. Once a book is sold, you know, there's a whole other issue about promoting the book. Are agents involved in that at all?
They should be. A good agent is with you through the whole process.
Some of the things that are changing now, you know, some of it's related to the general economy, but more of it is related to the nature of the publishing business is changing. Now in Britain, 25% of all books are not being sold in bookstores or places like that. They're being sold on websites, Amazon and the author websites.
You don't mean that just in Britain. That's true here as well.
Yeah. Well, Britain's ahead of us. It's coming here now. Now Amazon has passed Barnes & Noble in terms of who sells more books.
So
I think nonfiction is going to get much more attention. There's a New York Times story today.
We're into a family fight here. The nature of the novel still makes it the most important thing out there, but nonfiction has been for some time. It's easier to sell. It's easier to write. It's easier to sell. And I want to hark back to something Francesca said beforehand, because this is something I feel so personally about. It is absolutely true that the chemistry between you and the agent is so important. The right agent, knows, and a good agent stays with you for the long haul.
So give us some parting words here, both of you, Bill Martin and Beverly Swerling. What do you feel is the most important takeaway for people listening to this interview, people who might be already published writers or planning to publish or planning to write?
I spend an awful lot of my time looking for new agents. And the kind of criteria that I'm interested in when I see somebody say, what is the background of this agent? Because there are two basic skills needed in agenting. One is to be able to make the professional judgment of what's a book that'll sell. And two, the skill of negotiating. You know, there's an awful lot of new agents who come out of the publishing field, and there's going to be more and more of them as publishers shut down. And if they have a background as an acquiring editor, that's very important. The skill of negotiating, that's a gift of God, but people who start out agenting in major agents and then go out on their own probably spend their first years learning how to negotiate.
And the takeaway is that a writer needs the right agent. There are people ask us all the time, how many people who come to you get agents? We can never give them a figure. What I can say about that is that if your writing is first class, you'll get an agent. Whether you get the right agent may be the secret about whether or not that material sells.
Well, we've been talking with Beverly Swerling, novelist and consultant to authors about agents, along with her husband, Bill Martin, who's president of Agent Research and Evaluation. Well, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Francesca. It's a pleasure.
That's
Amen. Great. You can find out more about AR&E by going to their website, agentresearch.com. You can also sign up for their e-zine and read posts from Beverly's blog about agents and publishing. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net. To find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.